I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. School shooting, a phrase that's become all too common in America. Students can't help but wonder, will their school be added to the list of mass shooting sites? The safety measures schools take can be vastly different, but the goal remains the same, keep students safe. Today, we'll talk with two administrators about how their institutions are preparing for the possibility of a mass shooter on campus. Then, the Kansas City Symphony has gained a national reputation due in part to the efforts of Michael Stern. The music director will talk about his decision to leave the orchestra and his hopes for the symphony's future. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Kansas City area school districts are spending hundreds of millions of dollars on security upgrades in a bid to stifle future potential mass shootings. How much that's going to make students feel safe is an open question. Now, a conversation about how the schools train and drill students for active shooters. We'll talk about what districts have learned from other mass shootings, what changes they've implemented, who's developed their training protocols, and how often students run through these safety drills. With us, Rob McLeese is Director of Safety and Security for the 20,000-student North Kansas City School District. Rob, thanks for taking some time. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you.
Alisa Pacer is Director of Emergency Management for Johnson County Community College. Alisa, good morning to you.
Good morning, Steve.
Well, Alisa, all this money that's going for security upgrades, what's that money being spent on? What are schools doing in general to beef up their security?
So, in general, at Johnson County Community College, we have our own law enforcement agency on campus. I guess I consider that campus our small city, so that is our jurisdiction. And having that law enforcement serves as a huge deterrent for crime in general.
Mm-hmm.
Also, we do a lot of training, and I'll tell more about this, I'm sure, later on, but the ALICE program is the program that we selected for armed intruder events on our campus, and we make that mandatory training for our faculty and staff, so basically all of our employees.
Right. Rob, how about you? Where is all this money being spent when it comes to safety and security in the North Kansas City District?
Well, we, like Alicia said, they have their own police department. We utilize school resource deputies and officers, mainly from Clay County Sheriff's Office. Mm-hmm. We have an excellent long-term partnership with them, as well as Gladstone Police Department in North Kansas City.
Are these folks who are doing extra work after their regular shifts kind of thing?
No, their full-time job is to be a school resource officer for the
right?
school district, yes.
Yeah.
It's an excellent partnership with all three. We work closely with their area police departments, Kansas City Police Department, where 90% of our schools are at. For training, we use Stratagos International. They're based in Grandview. It's a train-to-trainer program. We do train our schools, and we team one police officer with one teacher or staff member, and they form one training team, and we train our staff each year before school.
You guys are talking about formalized structure for security at your two campuses here. You know, I grew up in an era when, you know, the school doors were always open. They were public buildings. This is a whole new age, isn't it, out there?
Well, I do think it is. I think Rob and I think the reason we're both here today, we have different viewpoints and some different challenges. For example, our institution, all of our 24 buildings on campus are still an open campus. So multiple entry points, multiple exits, and people can come and go as they please.
That's an extraordinary set of challenges when it comes to security, right?
It is. It absolutely is. And we have our public library on campus that anyone can frequent and visit within the community. We are a community college and serving that campus community. So.
Yeah. Rob, lots of exits, lots of doorways. I assume that applies to your school
right.
district as well.
And one of the differences between our two between the community college and the school district, the age, we start kids preschool 4 years old all the way up to 18. So we have a whole different student population. The needs are a lot different. The structure and how teachers and principals have to operate is a little bit different. We're like most school districts that I know of, or all of them, they have secured the doors. Mm-hmm. We funnel everybody into one entrance, the secured entrances, which you see virtually. I don't know any school district that doesn't do that anymore.
Yeah. You guys, does it go so far as to have metal detectors, cameras, fencing, vehicle barriers near the entrances? Alisa, is that what we're talking about here? Bulletproof glass?
You know, there are some of those that I say yes to and some not so much, but we do have barriers in front of our buildings, you know, to block for cars and those kinds of things, meaning to cause harm. And metal detectors, we do not do. We have evaluated that over the last few years, but it's just not something as an expense-wise that we would be able to do without really military, making our campus more like a military base or compound, so to speak. So.
Rob, do some of these words like bulletproof glass and cameras and metal detectors, does that apply to your district?
Like a lot of school districts, we utilize cameras for security, but also the expectations from parents has changed since you and I went to school. Bullying, items like that, it's something that the principal can use those cameras to help them through the school day as needed. Mm-hmm. Again, like her, we haven't most districts don't use metal detectors or the bollards out front. The logistics of doing something along with metal detectors would be quite enormous.
You just said the expectations of parents have evolved over the years. Right. What are the expectations of parents these days? What do they expect when they drop their kid off at school?
What they expect is that they're going to have a great learning day. North Kansas City School District says it's a champion for all students. And that's from top to bottom. It doesn't matter if you're a teacher or a support staff member. And they want, like everybody, they realize the challenges of the world have changed. It's more tech-driven. And so the education, unlike you or I maybe, college or going beyond that is a needed step. So they want their kids to be able to face and conquer those challenges when they leave, and that's what the school day's about.
I'm wondering, you said also earlier, Rob, that some of your students are young as 4 years old. How do you balance security with not scaring the heck out of kids who are that young?
First thing you need to do, and what we looked at a few years ago, we had a committee, we need to train our staff members. That's very important so they know what to expect and they know what to look for and they know how to respond in case of not just a mass shooting but any kind of emergency that might hit a school. We have fire and tornado drills along with the lockdown drills. The better trained they are, the better prepared they are, they're going to be able to handle something a lot calmer, a lot less stress, and they're going to be able to clearly tell the kids at any age, this is what we're going to do.
So you start at that level. But I remember, again, going back to my own childhood, you know, going out in the hallway and putting our heads between our legs, you know, in case there mm-hmm. was a bomb going off.
Right.
That was scary stuff. I remember being scared about that.
I think, though, the difference today is with more emphasis on security, using expert vendors to help us with active shooter drills, mm-hmm. that transcends into a better trained staff who's more prepared for any kind of emergency.
Yeah.
And that confidence, the teacher does know what they're doing, that flows down to the students.
Yeah. Alisa, at Johnson County Community College, do you ever get students who come to you and say, you know, I just don't feel comfortable walking around a campus that's as open as the JCCC campuses?
Yeah, of course. In my years of experience, we've had reports of that, and even from employees or faculty or staff members. And we take those comments very seriously, want to learn more about them, what can we do to help, and what can we do to make them feel more comfortable? Do we need? Oftentimes, we're not talking to parents. The parent expectations, I think, are a little bit different when we work primarily with adults. But we do have, for example, a children's center on our campus. So, you know, we have some young people, too, that we obviously take into consideration and is a priority.
So it's all this money that, like, your institution has spent, Alisa, and other schools. In general, do you think it's money well spent?
Oh, I absolutely do. Like Rob mentioned earlier, we have we just went from our old camera system, the old analog, to the new digital cameras, and I believe we have 534 installed right now. That's a lot of cameras. We have our active own dispatch center that monitors those cameras on a regular basis, and of course they can be used after the fact for investigations and those kinds of things. But cameras and postings that CCTV is in place, I just think there's many deterrents that can be recognized for in place.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR, and we're talking about school security in the North Kansas City School District and out at Johnson County Community College, two very different kinds of school situations. If you want to join our conversation today, 816-235-2888, or you can tweet us at KCUR Up to Date. You know, Rob, are there these days a set of best practices when it comes to securing these large high school campuses and even elementary schools that have emerged in recent years after all the shootings we've had across the country?
I think one of the things that and we may get to that discussion of the relationship. So when I started at the school district after retiring from the police department, one of the things that struck me is how interactive the principals are with the students every day. It's a lot different where we didn't see the principal. They interact a lot more. And as the trend continues, it's more towards building the relationships with students so they feel comfortable if there is an issue coming to their school resource officer or their principal, tell their parents. We have a way for parents to notify us. Either they can give us their name or do it anonymously. And the big thing with that is you follow up immediately so that they see you are taking action.
Meaning they give what, a potential threat?
It could be a threat, or maybe a lot of times it's a student who's contemplating self-harm. We get those, and we don't get them a lot, but we do get them. And if we get them at night, they come to me and the principals and the school resource deputies. We act upon them immediately. So if it's at 9 at night, we'll call Kansas City, Missouri Police Department or the appropriate agency, or maybe the Clay County Sheriff's Office will handle it for us.
Alisa, as you overlook a large campus out at Johnson County Community College, is there a set of best practices that have emerged for campuses like yours?
I think there's multiple sets of recommendations, best practices, standards from Department of Justice, different studies that have been done out of New York, FEMA, Department of Higher Ed. Department of Higher Ed has a lot to say in relation to emergency planning and what they recommend that schools are doing. So we try to take all of that into consideration, as well as paying attention to what's going on in the world so that we can learn from maybe what others have not done good or done well or not done so well.
Are there some of those practices that are kind of surprising or even counterintuitive? I don't know what I'm thinking about, but are there things out there that a lot of folks like me might not really even think about?
That's a good question. I'll have to think about that for a second. But just to mention one best practice, and I think it's more become a standard, especially in higher ed, to have what they call a threat assessment team. We call ours a behavior intervention team, where you're keeping your finger on the pulse of what's going on with your students, with your employees. And it's all about early reporting, early red flag behavior, early warning signs.
That comes from like professors?
Anonymous tips.
Fellow students.
Or anybody that reports that, whether in person or via our we have a hotline that you can call, or you can also report online anonymously or otherwise. But we take those reports very seriously, and we have to these days.
What happens what do you do if you get a phone call anonymously about the behavior of a student in a class? What do you do?
We would investigate it immediately. And if everything seems to be in line with being something credible, we would pull that student out of class and say, what are you thinking when you said this? Mm-hmm. And, and that's a law enforcement function, but also in collaboration with our student success and engagement branch and division. It doesn't mean necessarily always we're trying to get people in trouble. We're just trying to get to the bottom of what's going on.
How often do you get those phone calls?
Phone calls, not necessarily a lot, but we do have a lot of reports that we follow up on.
Yeah.
And some, like Rob mentioned, some is not to get someone in trouble or something they did wrong, but, it's a welfare alert. It's something that they're not in a good place themselves.
Mm-hmm.
So someone's concerned about another person.
Rob, how often do you guys get those phone calls or tips?
Tips, we use Crime Stoppers for scholastic crimes tips, and then the governor's task force on school safety and security develop Courage to Tell. So there's two avenues our parents could use. The governor's hasn't been as well known in our district, so we've used the other program for a while. We don't get very many of them. A lot of time, it depends. The kids will use it or they'll go to their administrator. We get a lot from the parents. We don't get a lot of them, but it's there. They know they can use it. The important thing, like Alicia said, they know we have to follow up. They have to see some action. These are students, so they want to see that you're actually following up and doing something. We work closely with student services. That's the part of our school district that it has the counselors and the school psychologist involved. Yeah. So we're able to at least offer that, and they're experts at referring families to resources they don't know about.
Well, let's turn to the types of drills that you guys might stage periodically to help prepare students and staff for a terrible thing that could happen. Are there laws, Alisa, or even standards that dictate how often you guys should stage a drill to get everybody on the same page?
Well, we're governed by the Clery Act.
That's a federal law?
It is. Issued from the Department of Higher Ed, or Higher Education Opportunity Act, sorry.
Mm-hmm.
And with that in mind, we have to report what crimes occur on our campus within certain categories of crimes, and so that parents and students know what they're walking into when they walk onto our campus, so that they're well informed as far as is this a safe campus? What types of crimes have they had occur?
Mm-hmm.
And so they know that the history's there, and that's all because something bad happened to a young lady a long time ago,
mm-hmm.
Where they didn't feel they were informed that those mm-hmm. types of things could or were happening.
Does that same federal law dictate what you do, Rob, at North Kansas City?
I believe that's just for higher education.
Mm, okay. And who dictates the protocols that you follow?
The state of Missouri says schools may do one lockdown drill a year with a law enforcement officer present.
One drill a year. Is that enough?
It would depend probably on your district, how the size and location and the makeup of your community. But what we do when we add our task force of principals and law enforcement officers to direct where we wanted to go with our active shooter drills, we determined we would do one lockdown drill per year. And before every school year, all teachers go through active shooter training inside their own schools, their own classrooms. And we do 2 hours of that training before the start of every school year.
And so every teacher does that in
every employee
every
does it,
employee.
Yes. But we train at their schools, so they're familiar with their classrooms, because all classrooms and buildings are different across the school district.
How seriously do students take those drills?
I think they take them seriously. I know that the staff does and the principals do, and from that it will flow down to the students.
How about at Johnson County Community College? When you do a drill, Alisa, how seriously do students take it?
It's interesting. At the community college, since we work primarily with folks 18 years of age or older, I don't know if it's a mindset or a generational thought process, but I spend more of my time and we spend more of our dedicated efforts training employees. We offer student training, but they're not always well attended. We wish they were more well attended. We don't have the control to make it mandatory for them to go.
Mm-hmm.
And there is no statute saying that you have to or you must. We offer it. We hope that they come. But we do have 11 train the trainers, like Rob mm-hmm. was talking about, on our campus. We team up officers with civilian trainers, and we offer that multiple times throughout the semester. And then we also do work group training, where we train and do scenario drills within the workspaces and the various buildings on our campus.
Is it enough?
That's a good question. I imagine it's probably never enough, and I've told my team that back at JCCC, our police department, and my assistant, and she said we can always be doing more, and that is always my goal. I set my own schedule. I'm as busy as I make myself, and I'm very, very busy.
Yeah.
So, but the fact that 10 years ago, when JCCC recognized that they needed a full-time dedicated person, kind of like Rob's position, those positions didn't always exist 10, 15 years ago. So the fact that that's being recognized and those efforts are being coordinated, I think, is a huge, huge step in the right direction.
I would just think, again, at a campus as large as JUCO's out there, that, again, the possibilities, there's such an open campus, there's so many ways for mayhem to erupt out there. I would have a hard time sleeping at night if I was in your job.
You know, there are certain things that keep me up at night, but, you know, safety and security, I have to have I believe in our team, and I believe in what we've accomplished. I know that in the last year, we were reported as the safest campus in the state of Kansas, and then the seventh safest school higher ed wise mm-hmm. in the nation. And I'm really proud of those standards. But you know, people, if we tout our horn on that, so to speak, I think that could grow complacency, and mm-hmm. you just can't get complacent. You have to keep striving and trying new things for improvement.
So, Rob, when you guys do drills, this one time of year you were telling me about, do you actually, you know, move desks over and block the doors, and you do everything you would do in a real life situation?
We do four drills, lockdown drills a year.
You guys do one a year.
No, that was the Missouri state law.
That was Missouri state law.
I believe
so you do
says
four
a
year.
Right,
you go
right.
beyond that standard.
Right.
Okay. Yeah.
Right. One per quarter. It depends on if you look at what Strategos teaches. They're all similar. The programs. It's lockout, get out, take out. So like you mentioned, an open area. Well, those are areas. You know, you first look at, can you lock out? If you can't, then you have to get out of the area. Mm-hmm. And that's the first thing we teach the staff is they're not always in their classrooms. There's just a lot of movement in schools.
And my question is, how realistic do you get? Do you actually have students running down hallways?
It depends how we do it. Typically, each school, the principal's in charge of setting those drills. And they'll base that on student population, their comfortability with the staff and where the staff is at, and questions from the staff. One of the things that we offer, because we have so many school resource deputies, two per high school, one middle school, one for the elementaries, and we have a supervisor over them, that they also go into the schools. They can talk to staff about issues with how would I do this or how would I do that. So we can get some one-on-one, and I imagine they can offer that too mm-hmm. at Johnson County Community College.
Do you have kids running down hallways, Elisa?
We have in some of the drills that we've done.
And the kids know ahead of time this is a drill?
They have, yes,
yeah.
They do. I think a lot of institutions have gotten, not in trouble, but been looked poorly upon when people have gotten scared or the wrong people didn't get notified that it was happening.
Can college students or professors carry guns on your campus?
Yes.
How does that change the math?
So back in 2017, the state of Kansas determined that all state institutions in higher ed could now conceal carry in our buildings.
Right. How did you feel about that?
It's not a matter of how I felt about it. My job was to implement and make sure we had good policy in place and make sure that our campus community felt comfortable with the changes that were coming. And we had a four-year process to prepare for that. 2013 through 2017, we operated under an exemption status where we chose the exemption not to have concealed carry versus and then the exemption expired.
Did all this complicate or simplify your job?
I think from a law enforcement standpoint, I think that it could potentially complicate just because people with a weapon, I think officers in general are concerned whether knowing that's the good guy or the bad guy mm-hmm. or person. Mm-hmm. And with that thought process in mind, though, it doesn't change the training. You know, a threat is still a threat. And if someone's there to do harm, you need to know how to protect yourself.
Yeah. We're going to have to leave our conversation. There are lots of things to think about as schools prepare for the possibility of mass shootings. That was the voice of Elisa Pacer, Director of Emergency Management for Johnson County Community College. We were also joined by Rob McLees. He's Director of Safety and Security for the North Kansas City School District. Thank you both very much for your time.
Thank you.
Honored to be here. Thanks.
After a break, when we come back, Michael Stern, the musical director for the Kansas City Symphony, joins us. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. During our program here, my guests have the mic, but in the Up to Date newsletter, I get to share my thoughts. Sign up for Kraske Off Mic at kcur.org/Kraske. It's quick and easy, and it appears in your inbox each Monday. That's kcur.org/Kraske. Today marks 100 days in office for Kansas City Mayor Quentin Lucas, which means we have plenty to talk with him about. Join us on Monday as we spend the show discussing the city's most pressing issues and taking your calls for the mayor. That's Monday on KCUR's Up to Date. If you only know this music from the film 2001, A Space Odyssey, then you should treat yourself to the Kansas City Symphony this month to hear what is actually the prelude to a complete work by Richard Strauss. More on that in just a little bit, but first I want to welcome the symphony's music director, Michael Stern, to the studio. Michael, so good to have you back here on Up to Date. Welcome.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
You know, lots to get to here, but I want to start with your contract renewal, your last renewal, which will take you through the 2022-23 season. First, executive director Frank Byrne retires. Now your departure is set. What's to become of the symphony here, Michael?
Oh, only great things.
Somehow I thought you might go there.
With his departure in mind, it's only things are only looking up. No, I think the symphony is in such great shape, mm-hmm. and we are so positioned for only great things to come. This seemed like a perfect transition. What was really, I think, a model of institutional comportment was the way we transitioned not just our executive directorship, but also our board leadership mm-hmm. and now the music directorship. We have to, if we want to be serious about loving the organization beyond us, we have to plan for the future. Mm-hmm. And in paving the way for Danny Beckley to come, we have absolutely safeguarded all of the great things that we've solidified over the past
The new executive director, right.
Danny being the new executive director. And this basically four-year ramp-up gives ample time to plan great seasons, to continue the work that has to get done both artistically, creatively, and for the case for music out in the community, and pave the way for the next great chapter in the orchestra's history.
You know, you have several seasons to go, but why plan your departure now?
Because there's never a time to do it until you do it, and we absolutely wanted the ramp up.
But was there something about 15 years in that you decided it was time for you to think about other things?
Well, I will be honest. My children are still young. Mm-hmm. I am missing them more and more, but I'm also on the cusp of a big transition birthday in my life. So maybe it was a midlife crisis.
30? You're turning 30?
Yeah, that's it.
Yeah.
30.
Yeah.
Yeah. Cut that in half and quadruple it. So I think that it will have been 18 years with the orchestra. That's not nothing. Plus, I was very touched by the offer from the board to make me conductor laureate. I love the orchestra. I love the city. I love the audiences. And I love the idea of what we have done and, more importantly, what we can do here.
What do you want to see in your successor? What does that person need to have first among all attributes, Michael?
A love of both place and craft. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's where and what that looks like.
And the rest of it takes care of itself.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
There should be somebody, you know, there's a pendulum swing, a natural pendulum swing with all orchestras that things usually go to the other, complete other extreme. And that's the way it should be. You know, change is good. Danny Beckley is very different from Frank Byrne. And I was very different from my predecessor. And I think the next person will forge a way to continue to safeguard the artistic ambition of the orchestra, but more and more penetrate the community and make the case for music and for the Kansas City Symphony being central to that cause of music.
Michael, to what extent has Kansas City embraced you and embraced the whole idea of a symphony in its midst?
I think that has been transformed since I got here. But I'm not a big fan of self-promotion, and I wouldn't tout our own horn. I mean, blow our own horn. Or I think that I feel very embraced and well-loved.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that what I love about that is that I think the musicians, the act of being in music in this community has been totally transformed mm-hmm. over the last 15 years. And I think that speaks to several things. First of all, obviously, the Kauffman Center has played a huge role.
Right.
The orchestra is completely unrecognizable from when I took it. Not in terms of the membership so much, but by they always had dedication. But, I mean, again, it's not for me to say, but they sound really, really wonderful. And
do you still get people out east in New York where you hang and live? Do you still get people saying to you, Kansas City, what are you doing out there?
Well, less and less mm-hmm. because between the recordings and the word of mouth, you know, I think the list of guest artists who have come here and who continue to come, I think are second to none. We equal any orchestra in the United States. And they talk. They mm-hmm. talk amongst themselves, but they talk to other people. And they sure. say, we just had this experience in Kansas City. You wouldn't believe it. Also, the guest conductors who come.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, people understand that the devotion and the level of artistry that they experience when they're working with the orchestra and what they feel from the audience, there's something different here.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not nothing.
The maestro himself, Michael Stern, the music director of the Kansas City Symphony, is my guest. You know, as you look down the road, what can concertgoers expect to see when it comes to the process of finding your successor? Lots of guest conductors in the seasons to come, or does that go without saying?
Well, that goes without saying. I mean, the idea, I think one of the worst mistakes that anyone can do in any field is to hire someone unvetted.
Mm-hmm.
And somebody who engages in the first 30 minutes and then doesn't sustain is not the person you want. You need time to actually identify your pool of candidates. It's like looking for a CEO for any corporation. It's yeah. like looking for anybody who's applying for a job. And this is more than a job.
Mm-hmm.
That's the point.
Mm-hmm.
So the whole idea of having this longer ramp up was to give sufficient opportunity for the orchestra to see new people, to re-see people that they've enjoyed working with, to see what the fit is, not only on stage, but in the community, with the board, with the staff.
I was going to say that your job is a whole lot more than waving a baton in front of a group of great musicians, right? There's a lot more. That's just a fraction of what you do.
Well, I always think of what the great conductor of the Cleveland Orchestra, George Zell, used to say, which is that the job of a music director is to direct. But that's not the job of a conductor. And the jobs of, or the roles of a conductor who is a collegial performer on stage with 100 other people and being the musical director of an organization are two very different things.
Mm-hmm.
So in terms of the way you plan an arc of the season, the way you have contacts in the world to bring people as guests, to commission new music, to make inroads into the community, to do meaningful engagement,
mm-hmm.
to invent projects which over time will bear fruit, to find corners of the endowment which will sustain meaningful work in the future. That has absolutely nothing to do with deciding on the tempo and the slow movement of a Bruckner symphony.
Right.
And yet, the two are weirdly related, because what you do on stage, which is the immediacy of the experience for the audience, is going to translate into those people wanting more. That gives you the platform to invent more possibility form music in the community.
That's interesting. You know, before we get to the upcoming programs, I wanted to turn to the continuing fallout from the Me Too movement, Michael. Star conductor James Levine was, you know, fired from New York's Metropolitan Opera. Then there were the accusations against star tenor Placido Domingo in September that saw him withdraw from the Met's production of Macbeth. And those aren't the only big names who have been called out. How does the Kansas City Symphony guard against that?
We are incredibly dedicated to tolerating no abuse, period. Mm-hmm. And we take every day. I think a lot of institutions think certain things should be taken for granted. We take nothing for granted. Mm. So I think it is important. I mean, this question is multi-layered and nuanced. And I mean, I think, first of all, flat out, I think the Me Too movement has done a huge service in being able to bring to light, when they haven't been for far too long, real issues of concern for many, many people, especially for women, but not only for women. I also think that some people have gotten unfairly hit in the crossfire. I don't know. I would not speak publicly about James Levine or Placido Domingo, mm-hmm. but I think the argument necessarily that, oh, of course, we all knew that, rush to judgment, while that's not fair, is also to be put in the pool with, it doesn't matter, that might have happened, but so-and-so is such a great artist, they get a pass. Mm-hmm. At the Kansas City Symphony, nobody gets a pass. So that's the bottom line.
You have a lot of big things coming up. I want to turn to that now. We played Strauss's Sunrise Prelude to open this conversation. Fill us in on this opus, if you would.
Well, this is an extraordinary work. I mean, Richard Strauss is well known for his incredibly descriptive, colorful, sort of larger-than-life technicolor scores. Don Juan, Till Eulenspiegel, an Alpine Symphony, a Heldenleben, a hero's life. This one is based on the famous novel by Nietzsche. And I used it as a cornerstone of this program, which really grapples with the big issues, because at the core of this program is the world premiere by my very dear friend Jonathan Leshnoff, who has been commissioned by us before. We've played his music before. We've recorded successfully his music before. In fact, this could very well be the companion piece to a CD that we will release with his third symphony that we played a few years ago in conjunction with our season that celebrated the anniversary of World War I. And Jonathan is a very devout, very spiritual person, and his music always touches the larger questions of existence and of life and of faith. It's a piano concerto written for another great friend of ours, Joyce Yang, brilliant virtuoso pianist. And we're going to play that at the heart of this program, which I then thought was a natural fit with this Zarathustra, because in this piece, Zarathustra, which of course is sort of the basis for the Zoroastrian philosophy, he's grappling with all of these issues of good and evil and morality and the search for truth and the journey in life to try to answer the larger questions, which is exactly Jonathan's mission, with a completely different vernacular, a completely different sound world, a contemporary composer in America writing a piece right next to, you know, the most archly romantic, with a capital R, music from two centuries ago. And we open with this unfinished fragment of a symphony, the first movement of what would have been Mahler's 10th symphony, which is, of course, also fraught with layers of angst and questioning and longing and the larger issues. Mahler knew that he was deathly ill. His personal life was in disarray with his wife. He had uncovered the fact that she was having an affair. They had lost their child. And he had this terrible superstition that any time anybody writes a 9th symphony, which he had done, they died. Hmm. So citing Beethoven and Bruckner and Schubert, there were all of these omens, right?
So he didn't get it done.
He did not get it done. He died.
Let's take a listen to Mahler's Adagio. You know, what makes this hold up as a solo piece, Michael?
Well, that ruminative, yearning, plaintive opening viola solo is so multi-layered as the piece develops, sort of more and more aching, longing, yearning music just gets folded one on top of the other, and you get swept in. You get totally captivated. I love this program because there is something for everyone. Even if you don't come into the concert grappling these big questions, you let the music wash over you. There is something incredibly powerful about surrendering yourself to this unbelievable beauty. And
well, even listening to that, it's just remarkable.
Yeah, but it gets better and better the further the movement goes. And the other thing is there's an added layer, right? Because you think, what if he hadn't died? He sketched out the other movements, but they're so incomplete that if you really do the 10th Symphony as a completion, it really requires the work of a lot of other music written by other people. This first movement is largely done. So it really is Mahler making his final statement. This is the last music he ever wrote. So in the context of all of this searching and looking for the big questions, I thought this was a perfect way to open the program.
Kansas City Symphony Music Director Michael Stern is my guest. You know, come December 16th, a really special evening for the Stern family, known as the Beethoven for the Generations, marks the start of the Isaac Stern Centenary in honor of your father and his contributions to the music, Michael. The symphony is bringing in some superstar guests for this evening, and who are they?
Violinist Pamela Frank, pianist Emmanuel Ax, and cellist Yo-Yo Ma are going to come on December 16th, which is Beethoven's actual birthday. There's a caveat to that. We don't know exactly when he was born, but we know he was baptized the next day.
Okay.
So chances are that was his birthday. And to honor the 250th birthday of Beethoven in 2020, and at the same time to kick off what has now become a global initiative to celebrate the 100 years of my father, these three pretty great people who are also incredibly close collaborators and colleagues of my dad's are coming in to honor him by playing Beethoven on Beethoven's birthday and to kick off this 2020 year of celebration for both of them. So I made a special point of not programming any Beethoven in the 2019 part of the season, to make the point that in 2 weeks' time, after December 16th, look forward, we've got a year of Beethoven. And it was a real decision for me. I mean, this was a project that my family, Yo-Yo, Midori, Pinkus Zukerman, a few other people who were very close to my father, decided to come together and try to engage not only the music world, but the world in general, around us, into the idea of acts of service for music, sort of music out in the world as a force for good in his name. Because when I thought about his legacy, yes, he was a great violinist. He was a great fiddle player, one of the preeminent musicians of the 20th century, and a huge force in music. But more than that, aside from the teaching and the legacy of all of that, he was a real activist. He was a real advocate for young people, for education, for music. And do we not need that now more than ever, more urgently than ever? I was sort of taking stock, and I thought, my father's legacy is real. Why should I not stand next to it and say, this is a model for... And certainly when you talk to people like Midori, like Yo-Yo, like Manny, it's not just the stories that they remember or the music making with him that they remember, but the idea of really putting your money where your mouth is. You know, there would not be, I think it's fair to say, there would not be a National Endowment for the Arts. There were lots of people working on it, but he was the one to sit in the Oval Office with President Johnson and make the case. All of the, you know, the cultural diplomacy that he did in the Soviet Union, in China, in Israel, the legions of young people that he touched with masterclasses and with inspiration and music and so forth. This is real. and it deserves celebration. And the way we imagined this project was that anything at all, it doesn't need to be a performance, anything that advances the cause of music out in the world as a force for good mm-hmm. could be part of this this initiative. We're launching a website where all of this will be chronicled. There are events planned from Japan to Europe, across the United States, orchestras, schools, you know, ancillary institutions like museums. We have a whole radio program, nationally syndicated radio program going on, all sorts of things which will all become public very soon. But it's all not to further the legacy only of the musician, but of what he left behind. You know, there's an old saying, a Jewish saying, that when you are called to your rest, you should be worthy of that rest. Mm. I think my father was worthy of his rest, and I think people should remember that.
So well said. Well, these superstars will be performing the third of the trio of Beethoven pieces to be presented that evening, fittingly called the Triple Concerto.
Actually, two-thirds.
Two-thirds.
Because they are also playing, I asked them, and they agreed, to play a piano trio, just piano, violin, and cello, a piece that they, at some point, Pam coached with him and Manny and Yo-Yo played with him. Beethoven's E-flat trio, Opus 70, number 2, which is one of the absolutely divinely inspired pieces that Beethoven ever wrote, sort of as an homage to the chamber music that they used to play with him. And then the orchestra will also play with them the Beethoven Triple Concerto on Beethoven's birthday. And it's all to service this next generation fund.
We're going to go out by listening to a little bit of the Triple Concerto. In the meantime, I want to thank Michael Stern for coming in today. Congratulations on your big announcement. Good luck with the big concerts ahead. Always a pleasure to see you.
A pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Yesterday on the show, Representative Emanuel Cleaver shared his concerns about the impact of impeachment in a deeply divided country. Hear that and other episodes at kcur.org/up-to-date. Find and follow us on Twitter. We're at KCUR Up to Date. You can follow me at Steve Kraske. And don't forget to like KCUR on Facebook. On Monday, Kansas City Mayor Quentin Lucas joins us to discuss his first 100 days in office, including meetings with the governor and, of course, the controversy over the naming of the Paseo. Our theme music is composed by the great Bobby Watson. We had help this week from Linda Scher, Maria Carter, Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Elizabeth Ruiz, and Jamie Hobbs. Have a great weekend, all. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.